We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome history professor, U of North Florida, David Courtwright, author of his latest, The Age of Addiction, How Bad Habits Became Big Business. Professor, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. It's good to be with you.
So, let me pull up here my notes. Let's just start with this notion of well, okay, rather than starting with limbic capitalism, because I think we will get there. Let's talk about the sort of the history of addiction, because in many respects, that's what your book basically takes us through the life of addiction, at least insofar as we've known it as addiction. When did we first contemplate the idea of addiction as opposed to, like, sometimes some people really like to do this stuff and it becomes a problem?
Well, it's clear that even in ancient history, people had a conception of addiction, of compulsive behavior that was harmful to the individual, that was characterized by craving. And it was usually associated with things like gambling or alcohol. So for a long time, even though they didn't use the word addiction, the concept was there. The point of the book is that addiction has really exploded in the last 40 or 50 years. So let me ask you a question. If you heard the word addiction 30 or 40 years ago, what did you think of?
Well, I mean, I was young, but I imagine I would have thought about, like, hard drugs, like heroin or
exactly.
Heroin.
No, that's exactly right. And now, if you look any place on the internet or you tune into the news or whatever, you're going to hear stories about compulsive overeating or sugar addiction or machine gambling addiction or social media use that's compulsive, internet porn, even habitual tanning. You've got the whole category of addiction has exploded in the last, say, 30 or 40 years, and that's really what the book is about.
And that explosion of addiction, is that a function of a society that pathologizes things, or is that a function of what we understand addiction has actually increased and encompassed more, I guess, silos of activity?
Well, it's a function of a lot of things. One thing that's happened is the commercialization of vice. So a lot of things that 100 years ago the government tried to suppress in the name of reform, like prostitution or pornography, which back then would have been called obscenity, or even the alcohol industry, a lot of things that the capital P progressives tried to regulate survived the reform onslaught, and then they grew as industries in the mid to late 20th century. But also new technologies have come along, and they have made possible things like compulsive social media use, which no reformer 100 years ago would have even dreamed of. So it's a lot of different things.
All right. Well, let's talk about this concept of limbic capitalism. I mean, when did this tell us about it first.
Well, okay, so the word limbic refers to the region of your brain that's responsible for pleasure and motivation and long-term memory and other really important functions that are linked to survival, and they're linked to your emotions. You need your limbic system, but paradoxically, other people can capture it, and they can make your limbic system work against you. And basically, limbic capitalism hurts us by undermining our appetite control. I mean, that's really at the core of addiction, is you lose control. And typically take food addiction, for example. Everybody needs food. Food is necessary for survival. But there are some people who have simply lost control of their eating. And that didn't happen by accident. There were people who figured out ways to create more and more delicious and brain-reinforcing foods, and some people became literally addicted to them. And by the way, I don't mean to suggest that everybody who's overweight is an addict. I think that's ridiculous. That's a misuse of the term. but probably a quarter of all people who are grossly overweight fulfill the criteria of full-blown addiction.
But what's the first? Can you pinpoint on like what the first sort of like major push for limbic capitalism would be? I think like the most obvious answer in my mind is tobacco, right? I mean, you had these companies that were clearly aware of the addictive properties of what they were doing and hid that.
Yeah, I think that's well put. They didn't necessarily know about the limbic system or the specific neural pathways for how nicotine addicted people, which is evidence that became available in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But they sure as shooting knew that they were dealing with an addictive product. And they mounted a very clever marketing campaign to expand the use of that product. So the classic example is that around 1900, it was mainly men who smoked. And so the industry saw that there was this whole other market, namely women, that if they could valorize cigarette consumption and make it seem glamorous and sexy and very au courant, then they could tap into this other market, which they did. So the limbic capitalism story is really tied into this larger story of the expansion of marketing and advertising in the 20th century.
And the limbic capitalism is just sort of like almost another level of sophistication as to the processes in which this addiction happens.
Yeah, and it's also a reference to the fact that some products are just inherently more dangerous than others. So capitalism in general has a set of problems that are potentially associated with it. I mean, any enterprise, don't keep two sets of books, don't exploit your workers, don't pollute the environment. There's certain rules that ought to apply to any business. But limbic capitalism is different from garden variety capitalism, which just makes ordinary durable goods, insofar as the products themselves are inherently problematic. There's a difference between a company that makes rakes and plows and nails and one that makes internet pornography or video poker machines, if you see what I mean. And that's what I'm trying to get at with this phrase limbic capitalism. There's certain products that target the regions of your brain that are tied into compulsive behavior.
And how sophisticated or how much awareness do those who are selling this stuff have? I mean, we use the example of cigarettes. I think, like, famously, I think it was this guy Edward Bernays, who I believe was Freud's like cousin or some relation, who was the one who put the cigarettes in the hands of the suffragette marchers, and that helped with that. I mean, how sophisticated are all of these sort of limbic capitalists?
They are sophisticated, and they've gotten more sophisticated. So you're right. In the early 20th century, there's a revolution in advertising. And I spent a lot of time in the advertising archives. Let me tell you, if you want to understand how the world really works, the best place from which to view it is in the collections, the special collections libraries, which have all these internal memoranda that ad executives write to one another. They know how to get you. Let's put it that way. But since then, there's been a kind of quantum leap in the ability to develop and market potentially addictive products, because there are all these new technologies. So that video game designers or computer game designers study patterns of mouse clicks, or they even track where your eyes are on the screen to see which features of a game prototype are most interesting to young players. So they've got all kinds of tools And that's one of the illusions that people have, I think, about the marketplace, is that a lot of people think, oh, I can control this. You know, I'm in front of a screen, and I can limit the amount of time I spend on it, and all the rest of it. But for no matter how smart you are, there are 1,000 people on the other side of that screen who are smarter than you are, who are figuring out ways to keep you glued to that screen in the new economy of attention. That's what's going on.
Let's just go back just a little bit about to this concept you have of liberating, enslaving pleasures. This is sort of like pre our sophistication in understanding of addiction, just, you know, with some vague notion of like people are doing stuff that's bad for them. But we're talking like in the I guess maybe around the 17th century, 18th century, maybe, where you had people using stuff because, you know, life was hard and there was moments of escape there. Is that, I mean, what is that paradox of things that both liberate and enslave?
It's a good paradox, actually. So I earlier used the phrase potentially addictive products and services. I try to make the point in the book that these things are not all evil, and they're not all to be avoided, and that in fact they've brought a lot of pleasure and even liberation into human lives in the course of history. I mean, you know, what's the matter with toasting someone with a glass of wine at a wedding feast? Nothing. There's a very humane and liberating aspect to many of these things. On the other hand, there's a potential problem, and the problem is that people will become such heavy consumers that they will harm themselves and generate social costs. And the temptation is for businesses to market these products in a way that they encourage heavy and destructive consumption in a certain subgroup of users, because frankly, that's where they get most of their money. So in the alcohol industry, for example, 80% of the revenues come from 20% of the users. And that's the built-in temptation.
Could this arguably just be a problem with capitalism? I mean, because you have era, you know, pre at least the capitalism that we understand today, and the sort of this, I guess, late stage of capitalism, where okay, people have access to alcohol. People have access to, I don't know, depending on where they live, like, you know, coca or some other a drug. And that on some level, because, you know, some people are going to be destroyed by them, but the numbers of people who will be are far less because the product, as it were, has not been so commodified. And then with this sort of machine behind it, to sort of insert it in our lives in a way that has been, you know, that I guess hyperinflates its allure in some way.
Yeah, Sam, listen, you should have written the book and saved me the trouble. I think you just nailed it. I mean, there are lots of things. You use the word commodify. That's part of the problem. There were many products that were not particularly harmful that became more so as a consequence of industrialization and commodification. Cigarettes would be an example, cheap booze, which was ubiquitous by the late 19th century. Another thing that's really important to keep in mind is that the historical context of what constitutes a dangerous product changes. So take alcohol as an example. There was once a time when water was very polluted and full of pathogenic microorganisms, and if you drank water, you were going to get cholera or some other terrible disease, and you were actually better off drinking something like beer. But with the public health reforms and the improvement in sanitation at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, suddenly drinking water is safe. And temperance societies start building what they call temperance fountains, or what we would call water fountains in many cities. And the message is, drink water, not booze. So that the sort of the risks and benefits of alcohol change in comparison to what the alternative beverages are, if you see what I mean. So it's a little bit tricky to say, you know, these things are always bad or risky or always addictive, but generally speaking, with the passage of time and the growing sophistication of technology and marketing, addiction has definitely expanded.
We should say, it just reminds me that Johnny Appleseed, he was going around growing apple trees. It was all vastly for apple cider. Hard cider.
Absolutely.
Hard cider, I should
Absolutely
say.
Absolutely right. Which, by the way, was exempted by the Volstead Act. Something that a lot of people don't know is that the rural interests that supported the Volstead Act, those people were mainly concerned about the working class in cities drinking. And so it's perfectly okay for farmers to keep fermenting their cider and drinking their cider. So there's a kind of double standard that was built into the legislation.
Interesting. And so let's talk about the sort of the anti-vices and the anti-vice activism, pro-vice activism. You dedicate a chapter to each, but let's, I mean, tell us what should we understand about the anti-vice activists? It wasn't simply all puritanical. I mean, I know that for instance, the part of the progressive movement at the time supported prohibition in part because they wanted an income tax, and alcohol had been a source of really the federal government's revenue. In terms of taxes, and they wanted to take that off the table for a while.
Yeah, and they're also worried about the corrupting influence of the alcohol industry, which owns a lot of the state legislatures. So this is actually politically, this is really interesting. So the people that historians call capital P progressives, that sort of turn of the last century progressives, were people who believed that it was necessary for the government to intervene in at least certain markets in the interests of economic justice, and also in the case of limbic capitalism, to suppress the consumption of certain products that they thought were bad for the public's health. And they weren't all religious. So there were some people who were religiously conservative people who were, you know, Baptist or Methodist, and they just thought alcohol and tobacco were evil. But there were also secular progressives who thought, yeah, you can make a case that these things are harmful and they shorten lives, and we should discourage their use, especially among the young. So they supported everything from out-and-out prohibition to age restrictions on purchasing things like tobacco products, to hours that saloons could operate. There's a spectrum of regulation that comes out of the progressive era. And it's not just in the United States. This book, The Age of Addiction, is a global history. And one of the things I try to show is that there were anti-vice progressives in every country. In fact, you know who the biggest anti-vice progressive in the world was in the late 19th and the early 20th century?
No.
Gandhi. It's Gandhi. We immediately think of Carrie Nation or somebody, but the person who is probably the most famous and consistent anti-vice activist is Gandhi, who thinks that she shouldn't smoke, that the government should enact prohibition, that opium production needs to be curtailed, that these things are bad for people. And you can find people all over the world who adhere to this. And if I could just extend that thought, what's interesting today is that there's a split among progressives, let's say small p progressives. There are economic progressives who feel still very strongly that it's the business of the government to regulate markets and to regulate capitalist enterprise, but they don't like the drug war, and they don't like religious conservatives, and they don't like anything that smacks of Puritanism. And so there's this very pronounced ambivalence about the government interfering with markets and what used to be called vice. In fact, they don't even want to use the word vice. So they're torn. On the one hand, they embrace the principle of government regulation, but they think, oh, well, if you let the government loose on drugs, we're going to have another racist drug war and so on. So there's this real tension, I think, within the left today.
Well, I would add, too, I mean, for instance, in the context of, let's say, in New York City, Bloomberg got rid of sugary drinks. Like, you couldn't buy a sugared drink that was larger. They couldn't have a soda fountain that was larger than 20 ounces, let's say, I think it was.
Right.
And
right.
In many respects, it's a little bit regressive in terms of a policy. It also doesn't address sort of some of the and we see this with other sort of products that were sold in terms of like with trans fat and whatnot, that it sort of I guess as a unintended consequence, or one that people were aware of, would maybe punish people who live in food deserts in certain urban areas and whatnot. But I mean, this dilemma extends itself. Where, I mean, I guess this is a question of, I mean, there's sort of like a weird sort of cross section of things like libertarianism and the sort of the definition of freedom in some respects.
Well,
go ahead.
So two things about Bloomberg. One, that let's be clear, the people who funded the repeal campaign in New York City, that was the food industry and the sugar industry, and they appropriated libertarian arguments.
Right.
You know, I agree with you that libertarians didn't like Bloomberg's nanny regulations, as they were called, but the people who paid for the posters and the ads mocking Bloomberg, that came from the industry because they were afraid about sales. And
I'm cynical
two,
enough to believe there's not that much daylight between those two separate groups of people anyways. I mean, so, but
well, all right, that may be as is. But the other thing that's important to understand is that Bloomberg wins in the end. All right. So there are now a number of cities across the United States that tax sugary beverages. Mexico has imposed a tax on sugary beverages. The World Health Organization has endorsed the concept as sound public health policy. So his problem was not that he was wrong. It was more like he was premature, because the idea is, in fact, catching on in other places.
Well, and also on the other end of that, the U.S. government heavily subsidizes the it's corn syrup, but the sugar that goes in those sugary products.
Yeah, well, one of about 50 examples of where the left hand or the right of the U.S. government doesn't know what the right hand is doing. I mean, that you're right. That's a point that just drives critics of the food industry crazy. Is you get one department in the government giving you good advice about what constitutes a healthy diet, and then you have other branches of the government that are subsidizing the mass production of unhealthful foods, you know, go figure. I think that's a familiar story to anybody, at least in American history, which is one of my fields, going all the way back to the New Deal, is that you'll often have government agencies and government programs working at cross purposes, which turns out to be one of the libertarian objections to government action, is because they fear that inevitably there'll be this kind of a screw up.
As a father of a 14-year-old girl, I have to now we have to talk a little bit about digital addiction and particularly mobility. You're right that there's basically three, I guess, things that sort of our connectivity does in terms of enhancing limbic capitalism. It's the connectivity and mobility itself and the products that it promotes. It's the the use of the internet to sort of hyper, I guess, charge older addictions, and that in both instances, both these things have been engineered to really zero in on our vulnerabilities, I guess, as human beings, and exploit those. I mean, and I guess this includes like things like gamification and beyond. But talk about the. I mean, I think it's fairly obvious that if people were prone to having pornography addiction or gambling addiction or I guess maybe even in some instances medications, the internet is going to sort of like enhance that as a delivery mechanism and sort of get rid of barriers to the bar to entry or the bar to addiction, I guess. But then there's something addictive in and of itself to the connectivity. Talk about that.
Well, so one of the things that I discovered is that, again, looking at history, if you try to think what are the preconditions for mass addiction, there are five things, and they all start with the letter A, so it's easy to remember. Accessibility, affordability, advertising, anonymity, meaning that if you're in an environment where nobody else knows that you're doing this, it's easier. And then finally, anomie, or basically social and moral alienation. Those are the five big contributing factors to mass addiction. And if you think about it, the internet basically supercharges all five of those things. It's five for five. And I think you're also right that in addition to making things like pornography or gambling or drugs or how do you use drugs or how do you grow marijuana, providing that kind of information to people or that kind of content, in addition to doing that, there are certain fetishes that develop around the technology itself. So that in the literature, for example, there's a whole literature on phantom vibrations, where people get so tuned in to their smartphone in their hip pocket that they think it's vibrating when it's not.
Get it? Because I got it. I have
okay.
that.
Okay. All right. Okay. So you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes.
All right. So it's a conditioned response. I mean, it's just ABC of psychology. It's a conditioned response. And one of the really fascinating things to me was how the elites, especially Silicon Valley elites, are very aware of the addictive potential of this technology, whether it's by accident or by design. But increasingly, they're sending their own children to what you might call digitally decluttered schools, or they're going off screen themselves. To me, it's fascinating that which used to be free, which is face-to-face human interaction, has become a luxury good. It's almost like it's a mark of social status or a sign of upward mobility. So if you walk into a restaurant and you see a bunch of apparently well-educated people having a lively conversation at a dinner table, and then at the next table there are a bunch of kids who are lost in their smartphones, just ignoring one another, which of those two groups would you guess is upwardly mobile?
Right. I think there's like these Waldorf schools now, these private schools that have been around for quite a while that eschew those type of things. And so what can be done? I mean, you address this. It really does seem to be a question of society. I mean, to sort of, on some level, you know, Bloomberg in terms of his sugary drinks may have provided some type of answer. And maybe before we get that, I should just say that my understanding is that the research on the mobile phones, this latest generation, like kids literally my daughter's age, are unique in terms of, the demographic studies have shown like a dramatic change in children, essentially, or, you know, young teens in terms of their generation, in terms of like things like drug use, alcohol use, teen pregnancy and whatnot, but rises in anemia, as you say, and depression and anxiety because specifically of the mobility that comes with a phone as opposed to even in like an iPad, apparently. So with this sort of knowledge that we have a real, I mean, this is a real health crisis, right? I mean, this is like in the same way we have a measles outbreak and they say, okay, we're going to moratorium on your ability to avoid getting vaccinations. There has to become a society-wide understanding that this is a public health crisis.
Well, it is insofar as things like distracted driving really can kill you. You're right. I mean, there is a risk to life and limb. Although you have to be careful to distinguish between that risk and, say, the risk posed by cigarettes. Although just in listening to what you were saying, I had a thought, which is maybe each generation has a special vulnerability. So if you grew up in the United States in the 40s and 50s, the thing that was going to get you, the big threat, was cigarette smoking, which was very, very widespread, especially among the young at the time. And now that increasingly the threat comes from digital technologies, which, whatever they may or may not do for your health, are really bad news when it comes to education, for example. There's a massive amount of digital distraction that doesn't help learning. You're right about that. As to your first question, what can we do about this? I think tax policy is part of the example. Part of the solution to the problem. I think that Bloomberg was on the right track. And I think that it's not just sugary drinks. I wouldn't limit it to that. I think that alcohol and a lot of other things are undertaxed. I think getting serious about enforcing age restrictions. I think government monopolies for certain kinds of really addictive products like Schedule II and Schedule III controlled substances, that's a policy option that's out there. I mean, if you take something like opioids, we have to have opioids. They are life-saving in certain circumstances. These are valuable medicines. But do you want them necessarily marketed by private enterprise that's seeking to maximize profits for that particular category of products? By the way, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm just thinking out loud here. But certainly 100 years ago, there were people who would make the argument that alcohol is an inevitable presence in our society. And so, therefore, we would be better off if all of the pubs and the saloons and the taverns were run by the government and strictly managed by the government so that the saloon keepers were put on a salary and they didn't have the incentive to keep pushing booze so that everybody got drunk. And lastly, let me just say that ridicule is a much underutilized tactic in fighting back against limbic capitalism. Some of the most effective public health campaigns have been those that have held up people like tobacco executives to ridicule. And ridicule is especially effective, I think, for young people. And I think that that's something that we could develop more than we have.
That's Well, both those things are fascinating because on one hand, I mean, I could see Bernie Sanders coming out tomorrow and saying that we need to nationalize the production of some classes of medications like opioids. I mean, it's hard to argue that it is safe for society to allow capitalists to be responsible for the production of these drugs. They just literally killed hundreds of thousands of Americans and immiserated maybe millions because of their pursuit of profits. And I should say, just for the sake of fairness, that I think one of the Sacklers, you know, complained that it was difficult on their kids to go to school because of all the negative publicity for them. But
yeah, no, are you thinking of the David Sackler interview in Vanity Fair?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, the reason maybe you hear some hesitation in my voice is that you do get innovation. I mean, look at another example, smartphones. So you and I have been talking about the potential abuses or dangers, especially for young people, of being obsessed with your smartphone. On the other hand, the smartphone is a really great piece of technology which helps people navigate from place to place, which makes it easier to make 911 calls. I mean, there are lots of benefits that are associated with this technology. And I guess somebody who was defending free enterprise would say, well, you know, did it take an Apple to develop this technology? Would this have necessarily come out of a nationalized telecommunications industry? That's a fair question to ask. And that's another reason why I use the phrase liberating enslaving pleasures in the book, is because I don't want it to come across as just entirely one-sided or puritanical, because I recognize that these same products and services that can cause so much mischief and so much misery and even death can also be liberating and life-saving in other circumstances.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and I think we can I'm happy to come to an agreement that maybe what we need is just on a case-by-case basis decide what we're going to nationalize.
That's right. That's a good insight. That when we talk about limbic capitalism, we're actually talking about a whole range of industries. And I really believe that some of these products are intrinsically more dangerous than others, which, by the way, is why the government in the Controlled Substances Act says, okay, we've got Schedule 1 drugs, which are forbidden, and we've got Schedule 2 and 3, which are tightly regulated, and Schedule 4 and 5, which are less tightly regulated. I mean, that's nothing if not an acknowledgement of what you just said, is that some drugs are more dangerous than others.
David Courtwright, the book is The Age of Addiction, How Bad Habits Became Big Business. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Sam, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Bye-bye.